Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Welcome to Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers meant to encourage, educate, and empower gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing local experts and garden enthusiasts. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live and work on Indigenous land. I am the daughter of Middle Eastern immigrants on my mother's side and unknown, most likely European origin on my father's. With certainty, I and my ancestors have contributed to systems of colonization. I acknowledge this and am working towards a greater understanding and respect for past, present, and future Alaska Native peoples. I humbly and gratefully work and reside on the lands of the Dena'ina, Supiak Iluktik, Yupik, and Ketchumek peoples who have stewarded this land since time immemorial. Thank you. This episode is about Alaska Native plant traditions. We talk with Elder Kathy Brewster of Nanwalek about medicinal plants within Iluktik Supiak culture, King Island Inupiaq, traditional wellness consultant with the Kenaitse Indian tribe and founder of Indigenous Herbals, Tia Holly, talks about King Island and plants and practices for healing. And Nicola Revelo from Homer Soil and Water Conservation District has your weekly roundup of current events in local agriculture. A note to the listeners, our first interview with Kathy Brewster was conducted last fall, so some of the questions specifically address fall harvesting. Let's get started.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Kathy Brewster from Nanwalek. I'm in Nanwalek. It's 20 miles out of Homer.
Are you Supiak? Is that the majority of people that live in Nanwalek?
Yes, but I think we're mixed now. We have people from Southeastern marrying into the ladies here, and a lot of people from Iliamna that moved to Saldovia from Jackalov and find their way down here, married into the people here that was living. And then we have some from Copper River, and that's in Southeastern, the mouth of Copper River. The village called Iak. And then we have people from Southeastern, that's from around Cordova, that area. And everyone that moved here still were using their language. Then we have some Russians. My dad was from Ninilchik. The last name was, my maiden last name is Kvasnikov, and I guess that's it then.
So I wanted to ask you how long you've been harvesting plants, but really this was a polite way of me trying to ask how old you are.
Okay, about 77. I've been using them since 77.
So for this episode, we are talking about different things that people are harvesting. We were wondering if there was any native plants that you harvested during the fall.
We sure do. We have problem with our medicines, hardly getting any at the clinic, so we figured with this year we'll harvest more than what we can carry. I mean, half a hand.
And what are some of these plants?
The medicinal plants are pineapple, wheat, nettles, Bethlehem star, yarrow, wormwood, sweet goldsfoot. We still use them in the village, and most of the information is passed on orally, how it's made, knowledge has present. Here has been scientifically not tested. It's not tested. The plants were not tested, but we used them.
Is there a favorite plant that you have or that you like to consume during the fall?
Yes. One of them is wormwood. That's the valued medicine. When you have pneumonia, whooping cough, or cold, you put on lots of blanket before you go out and switch with the leaves. Then you get into the steam house and you switch. And then when you come out from the steam house, you put lots of clothes on and then you go to bed. The way we notice pneumonia is it's something, you're running a high fever and you're cold and your chest is hurting and you're coughing a lot. Then I have a yarrow used for a big infection, for rash, itchy, for boils and blisters. And then I have Bethlehem star. Bethlehem star is year-round medicine plant. When you have sore throat or lung disorder, you drink that, and you don't drink too much, like you take 2 teaspoons, because it's a strong medicine. It grows around under the trees in wintertime, away from the snow. The plant is year-round, and it just have one flower, and the leaves, we don't use the flowers for drinking it. We put in leaves. And it's good for your lungs when you drink it, when you're not feeling, you know, you have chest problem.
It sounds like most of these plants that you were talking about utilizing, you use them in a tea form or in like a steam bath?
Mm-hmm. Like a tea you drink. And the yarrows, I think they're popular, because you can put lots away for winter, and then before you put them away, you wash them up, make sure, you know, they're not from the dust, you know, sometimes they're dusty, and so you have to really wash them. And then you hang them up to dry, to preserve them for winter. And, oh, the red currants, northern red currants, people use them for eye problems, or they wash their eyes with that red currant with water, and that's how they take care of their eye problem. And the nettles is another one for for 2 days. They soak them in warm water, get them real hot, and then put them on the real hot rock. And after that, you put them in your mouth where you have toothache to get that rotten tooth, infected tooth off. You bite on it. Even though you know it hurts, you just hang on there. And the next day, or the tooth comes out. And that's the only way we could take care of our teeth whenever they start hurting, and to take them off. And the Devil's Club. Devil's Club are popular too. We make salve out of them. And Devil's Club is the ones you take the brown skin off and the needles, and then you boil it and you drink that with for like a tea. If it's too strong, you add water. That's how you take care of your cold and sore throat and chest problems.
Many people have told me about different times of year that they harvest Devil's Club root. I'm wondering when you prefer to harvest it.
In summertime, it's the best time because they have the vitamins, you know, on that Devil's Club go down to the roots before winter. So we pick them in summer and fall. And you can't pick them in winter time, you know, there's no vitamin in them. And it doesn't help much with, but you use the roots, that's where all the vitamin goes down. What we do is take off the needles and that brown skin, you scrape it off, and then when you get to that green, the inside, you take that off with the knife too, and that's what you save for winter time. And make sure it's in paper bag instead of plastic. I guess I left one more. A tree. We use a tree gum for colds. Like there's a yellow and pink one, but we use the pink one because the yellow one is just too sticky. And the pink one doesn't stick to your teeth or anything. That's what we pick a lot. And, when people like our parent, our dad and my brothers go up to get some wood in winter time, they would bring whole bunch of gum, tree gum. And we didn't have a store, so it was a big thing for us in the family when we get tree gums.
What kind of tree is it? A spruce?
Yeah, spruce tree.
Where did you learn these methods from?
From my parents. It's passed on orally from parents. And then I got interested because Mom always stored away a lot of plants for winter time. I had a friend who passed on, and she's always showing me how to do the plants. And then I was involved in doing the plants with Chuget's Mute when they were putting the books together.
Could you clarify the books that you're talking about?
The books I was involved with Purcella Russell. And then I went around and did a lot of workshops on with the books, you know. And then I was doing workshop on the books too, with the doctors in Anchorage, and then what's their place? And I was doing it with the schools too, doing presentations. The last one we worked was traditional medicinal plants of Suchbeck. And we did a lot. Priscilla wasn't with us, she was someplace else. The books, we helped her, I helped her to an Aleutic plants. It's by Priscilla and people from Port Graham and from here. We have plants that are poisonous, some of them. And our parents used to let us know which one is poisonous, which one is not. Once in a while, I'll go to school when they have no students coming in. I usually teach them and help them which ones are poisonous not to eat and which ones to eat.
Do you do any harvesting, you know, with your children or grandchildren?
Yes.
Is there anything that I've missed or anything that you wanted to talk about?
No.
My collaborator on this project, she had a question for you. She's wondering if there's any lore or legends involving some of the plants that you mentioned.
Yes. Oh, some of our plants are the food we eat in summertime, like goose dung and wild rhubarb and wild celery. And wild rice, wild chives. The way we preserve those wild chives in summertime is you put them in the jar, then you salt them down because we didn't have any freezers. And most of our fish was dried and salted because we didn't have, same thing, we didn't have a freezer to freeze them.
Do you have any funny stories about the plants that you work with?
Yes, one of them are sweet coltsfoot. After you pick the plant, you have to pay them. You put either nickel or, you know, money in there or whatever you want to put in to pay them back for pulling it. And those plants, we have to go for long distance, like maybe to Port Graham, the closest town, I mean village, and then towards Flat Island, where it's a long walk.
So if I'm walking and I see some coins by a plant, I should just let them be?
Yeah, I think so. I've never picked any sweet coltsfoot. That's what they are.
Are there any other stories about plants you would like to share?
In fall, just before it freezes up, I noticed a lot of people are out getting their plants. And they're so busy, you hardly see them anymore. We even get into berries, like making a lot of jam and everything, and people are so busy. One time I was, we still put away fish, we jar them, and our jams and smoked fish. One time my mother-in-law and I were making jarred fish, and she was by the stove, all at once our pressure cooker top came off and flew up to the ceiling. And I just ran outside and left her alone. And I feel bad about that. It was nice talking to you, ladies.
It was very nice talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good night.
And that was Kathy Brewster of Nanwalek. Up next, we talk to Tia Holly. She is the traditional wellness consultant for the Kenaitse Indian Tribe, founder of Indigenous Herbals. She talks with us about a history of King Island and plants and practices used for healing. Introduce yourself.
Well, my Inupiat name is Asana. My English name is Tia Holly. I've lived in the Kenai Soldotna area for 40 years this year. I am Inupiat Eskimo, but I was born and raised in the lower 48. Between me and my husband, we have 10 children and 13 grandchildren with another one on the way. I have worked for the Kenaitse Indian Tribe as an addictions counselor, and now my position is traditional wellness consultant. I get to do wonderful things, like we have a raised bed garden of wild plants, plants that are traditionally used by the Dena'ina Athabascan people here. We have those raised beds on the campus in Kenai. For that position as well, I get to go out on harvest trips with the elders and the youth. We have workshops where we can make salves with our nutritionist. We sometimes do different foods like dandelion muffins or spruce tip cookies with a wild plant. So for the food items, it's definitely things that Indigenous people would have ate, but with a modern ingredients and modern processing. And my family's from Ugiyevmut, which in English is King Island, up in the Bering Strait above Nome, but below the Diomede Islands. My mom was the last generation to grow up on King Island, and she passed away at 80 years old a little over 2 years ago, and had 12 brothers and sisters. And so I have, on my Inupiat side, I have 87 first cousins. So I'm related to a lot of people through marriage. King Island people being on an island for, they've found at least 600 years. I mean, it's a little 2.2 square mile island just jutting out of the Bering Sea that they lived on through the winter time. And Ugiyevmut means a place for winter. And their main source of food was walrus. And for some reason, just until I decided to go into the Master's in Rural Development class through UAF and focus on traditional plant use, I had always imagined on King Island, since there wasn't any trees, they built their houses on stilts using driftwood. I didn't imagine them having a diverse flora and plants that they used. I had started the master's program and couldn't find anything on King Islanders, and I thought I really wanted to learn more about my heritage, and I was ready to give up, and somebody asked me if I knew about the King Island plant book, and I said no, but that, you know, really got me back into my master's program.
You had mentioned that your mother was the last generation to live on King Island, and I'm not sure if a lot of the listening audience knows what happened or knows a lot about the history of King Island. Could you talk about what happened to the people that live there?
In the early 1900s, there's a priest from the Catholic Church that came, and the King Islanders decided he wasn't no problem. They let him stay there for a summer. And my great-grandfather lost his brother that summer. And the priest just sat with my great-grandfather and just spent time with him throughout the summer. And so he thought he was okay. And while the priest was there, I guess they had on one side of the island where a lot of people had been lost in the fog, adults and children, they said there were spirits there. But after the priest came, the spirits were no longer there. And then, according to one of my oldest uncles, my late uncle Vince, some of the King Islanders decided they liked the Catholic Church, and they built a church, and then they built a school in the 1930s. By the 1960s, they shut down the school. And the King Islanders, like I said, you give a mute means a place for winter. They lived on the island during the winter. So before it got icy up north, you know, they'd either go back with their skin boats or hitchhike a ride with the North Star, one of the big naval ships. But when the school was condemned, I've learned there was social workers meeting the King Islanders at the beach and telling them if they tried to take their children back to the island, that they would take them away. Just within a very short time, this village of an average of 200 people who'd lived very well on this island for at least 600 years all had to move to the mainland because their main source of food was from the sea. It was walrus, seals, their main sustenance. They had a big ice cave on the island where they would hang the meat. They each had their own dog. So, you know, you had to have a place where you could hang up meat that the dogs couldn't get to. But it also was like a giant refrigerator. So they had food year-round. And there was a couple of starvation times. One, when the whalers were told they couldn't whale anymore, they killed every animal they could see, including all the walrus that they could see, and the King Islanders survived on the seaweed and plant material that washed up onto the rocks. But yeah, that everybody moved to the mainland within, I think, probably about 4 or 5 years, when you couldn't raise your children and teach your children how to live there. That was it. They had their first suicide. They started to have lots of problems with alcohol. And people had drank before. My grandparents drank, but it wasn't a big deal. And when they went on the island, you know, where most people didn't even take alcohol there because it was a place for winter where you worked and you had plenty to do. But my uncle didn't. He ended up having an alcohol problem. My mother did. I'm second generation in recovery. Yeah, but before my mom, we didn't have alcoholics on my Inupiat side of the family. But yeah, pretty much they took the school away, Western school away, and they stayed together pretty much in like what they called King Island Village. In the early 1800s, they would take their giant skin boats that would hold like 30 people and all of their belongings, and just tip them over on the beach on the mainland and live out of there. But I guess some federal people didn't like that, so they made them some little Quonset huts. And my mom remembered growing up there. She was 12 when she had to stay and take care of her younger brothers and sisters. She dropped out of school at that time because both my grandparents were flown out of state for tuberculosis treatment. And so then the King Islanders, once they moved a little bit further away from each other, my uncle said it just wasn't ever quite the same because Father LaFortune was the priest that started the church on the island, and Father LaFortune was very protective of the people there. And thankfully, he was not one of the priests that sexually assaulted children in Nome.
The King Islanders, did they all settle sort of in one community? Is there a way that you would meet together?
I have met quite a few of them here and there. There are quite a few living in Anchorage, but they're not together. They do have feasts, and I have been to a couple of gatherings of King Islanders in Anchorage. They do have a drumming group in Anchorage and also in Nome. And I have been, like I said, I've been to Nome. There's a lot of King Islanders in Nome. There's quite a few of them in Anchorage, but they're spread out in Nome too. And I think that going from where you're like 10 steps away from your cousin's house or your auntie's house, or, you know, just being so close to, even if it's just around the corner, it can make a big difference, especially when you have a society that's saying you need to be individual, you need to go to school, you need to make money, and these need to be the most important things in your life.
Do you see any similarities between plants of King Island or farther north places and the plants of the Kenai Peninsula?
There are some similarities. Wormwood here, I think in the Nome area too, they have Artemisia tillese. My mother had to drink tea made out of that when she was little, when she was sick. It's really a good pain reliever. Tastes awful, but my family calls it stinkweed. And here, my late mother-in-law from Tyonek, they would use it as a switch in the steam house for aches and pains. And then today we add a little olive oil and beeswax to make a pain salve. And that's one I have a business, Indigenous Herbals, and when I sell products at like AFN, where you have people, Native people from all over the place coming in, I always bring some of the dried stinkweed or wormwood with me and have it available for when elders ask me where they can get it. Beach greens is one of the plants that I've seen growing here on the peninsula and down in Homer, and that grows all up and down the coast as well, all the way up to Nome and maybe even a little further. The tundra tea that people use, there's a couple different types of plant. One has a larger leaf, one has a smaller leaf, and I don't know which one grows where, but they have that same tea up in the Nome area as well as here locally. Up there they call it Eskimo tea, and down here they call it Indian tea. Of course, they don't have spruce trees on King Island or any large trees, but willow is another one that was used for medicine. And then young willow leaves were eaten by the King Islanders. And there is one more plant around here that's coastal, is beach lovage is the English name for it, that grows here as well as up in the Nome area in King Island.
What are the willow leaves used for?
Well, you can make it as a tea. Up north, the Inupiat name for the leaf that they find in the spring and eat as a green is sirah. And the English name for that particular type of willow is the diamond tip willow. Not diamond willow, it's a diamond tip willow. I've tasted a lot of spring willow leaves, and I think I tasted all 27 that were not, that are very bitter, because it does taste like aspirin, until I found the 28th willow bush that was the right one, growing out in the middle of a bunch of water out at Swan Lake here near Kenai. For this area, it was used for medicinal purposes. There's a really fantastic book written by Priscilla Carey Russell, who we've been able to work with and doing presentations and having her come in and present and share with the tribe. She spent about 30 years traveling around Cook Inlet recording the plant uses of the Dene Ina people here and published the Dene Ina plant lore book, which we use in our classes and definitely as one of our reference books for what we do at the tribe. She's gifted the whole publication to the tribe, and that one has been published. And before COVID, there was another publication getting ready, but since COVID hit, there's been some not so good luck on connecting everybody back together again. She also wrote a book for Nanwalek, Port Graham, and then one for Kodiak. The Kodiak one was pretty recent. And she lived in Homer for years. And you guys have the other author, Jenna Schofield, who wrote a book that I do recommend for a lot of people that are interested in learning more about wild plants for food and medicine. She was one of the first people I got to attend her workshop on edible Alaskan wild plants in Seldovia. I learned a lot. Her workshop really helped boost my bravery, I guess, to go out there and try some new plant materials. And if you learn the plants that are poisonous, if when you're going out, especially when you're going out to harvest a new kind of plant that you don't know about, the best thing to do is to go with somebody who knows the plants in the area that you're looking. I know that the kid who died in the woods with the bus.
Oh yeah, the movie Into the Wild. Christopher McCandless.
Yeah. I think one of her pet peeves was that people said that he had read her book and killed himself by eating peas, the wild peas. You could die from eating store-bought peas. The chemical that's in the wild peas might be a little stronger, but she said she never recommend anybody to just live on one thing. She did not promote anybody to go out there and just live on peas or any particular plant.
When you recommended her book, are you talking about Discovering Wild Plants? Is that the one that you're...
Jen Schofield?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what are you looking forward to harvesting this spring?
One of my favorite things in the spring is spruce tips. And I especially like promoting things like spruce tips, dandelion blossoms, plants, stinging nettles are all fantastic plants. Easy to identify, have some really good nutrition in them. For the spruce tips, vitamin C, the nettles, the vitamin K, and the dandelion, I can't remember if it's vitamin A or D in the blossoms, but the dandelion's kind of an unusual plant. It has different nutritional values in different parts of the plant. Oh, sorry. I don't know what he's doing in there. It sounded like a fire extinguisher, so I hope that's not what it was. He's cooking our dinner. I collect books, and I've got some really early books, like 200 years old. One of them that is around here, I haven't looked into it for up north, is Angelica. But European people used Angelica as well for medicine.
We have it growing in our garden. We collected some wild and then transplanted it into our garden.
It's a beautiful plant. It does have some strong medicinal properties. We don't promote that one for like our classes that we have. I mean, we don't do classes that really delve into identifying different plants, but because Angelica, especially in Homer, can be growing right next to...
Water hemlock.
Yeah, poison water hemlock. But you can eat the Angelica too, but you can eat like spruce bark some of the books that I've looked through, a lot of the indigenous remedies that have been recorded, you know, are for like starvation food, but also tuberculosis. And I'm sure if they were recording what medicinal purposes people were using plants for when there was smallpox epidemics, they would have probably used it for that as well.
What are some of your favorite plants for medicinal purposes?
Well, I love the stinkweed. It was the first plant that I used to make a medicinal salve. My mom and myself and my youngest daughter, Marina, went up to Nome to visit and pick berries with auntie and uncle that live up there. And we picked berries way too long one day. And my mom had both her hips replaced, and she spent the night just having to get up and walk around because her legs hurt so bad. And I found some salve up there with stinkweed in it, and she tried that, and it worked right away. And so when we were coming home, my aunt gave me this huge bag of wormwood that she had in her freezer. She said somebody had given it to her, and she didn't ever know what to do with it, but she said, you need to take this home and make some salve for your mom. So I got home and called her up and said, well, how do I do it? And she said, I don't know. You figure it out. So my first salves have a lot of different ingredients in them for pain relief, because that was the other thing of not finding any books in particular that talk about the process and practice of making medicine out of plants as an Alaskan native. Also, you know, I thought back then that more things going into the salve would make it better. But our Alaskan plants, I think it was Dennis Schofield I first heard say that there's been studies to show that the plants in the circumpolar north are stronger because of the shortened growing season. Plant really has to work hard to survive up here in the cold.
As in their medicinal properties are stronger?
Yes, the medicinal properties have been found to be stronger. And wormwood is one of those plants that was used by the American Indians as well. And then I went to Nanwalik. People wanted me to make some stuff with Devil's Club, and we do have it here in Kenai, but I had never really noticed it before. My friend from Nanwalik actually sent me this huge plant in a box to Kenai. So she sent me like a 4.5 foot tall Devil's Club plant for me to plant in my backyard because I didn't know where to look for it. You know, and once I found it, then I realized I'd been driving by it for decades. But I still didn't feel comfortable making anything out of the Devil's Club because it's really strong medicine. And that's not something you find up in Nome. It's not a King Islander. No, and I heard that you guys had interviewed a couple elders last year, and one in Nanwalik. I have a good friend of mine. We went through Rural Human Services School together, kind of a cohort model for years. But Nancy Radke from Nanwalik was my roommate for like 7 years when we would go to school for 3 weeks at a time. But my friend Nancy, we went and harvested some, took it over to her auntie's house, and her aunt showed us how to make the salve. And you know, it was just a beautiful experience. Her aunt gave me a little, it's not quite a book, but something she wrote on how to stay healthy as an Alaska Native in a village. And it was just simple. You know, if you're living a traditional lifestyle, walking out to harvest and gather or hunt or fish, you know, you're outside, you're being physically fit, you know, even picking berries, you're not just finding something for nutrition, you're also out there in the fresh air and walking, and you know, you're moving. It's hard to do that in the cities. The other thing I learned from Nancy and my other classmates that have grown up in villages, she's an artist, so she drew this picture of all these different faces of people, like in a circle around a mom and a baby, and it was their support network, you know. So it could be, you know, your uncle the joker, or your auntie the disciplinarian, or, you know, different people that play different roles in a small community like that. And that's part of, you know, just an attitude of when you're harvesting, you're not thinking of yourself as an individual. When you're harvesting, you know, you're grateful for the plant, for the ancestors that were good stewards of the land, but also in how can you share that and how can you help others with that. So, and that's something that is, I found, pretty universal for the different Alaska Native people that I've talked to from all over the place. I know it's sharing. There is quite a few books written about King Islanders, and sharing was one of their big values. If you had enough, anything over what you absolutely needed should be shared.
Is there any ritual in the harvesting of plants? I know certain people maybe bring gifts like tobacco for the plants, or they have a rule about how much of a plant they will harvest.
For my business, I've made a little harvesting kit, and it, you know, the biggest thing, and I teach a class at the Kenai Peninsula College, and then I taught a class for UAA last fall, which was challenging to do a distance class where you do look at the mindset, and normally we would go out as a group out into the woods and harvest and practice just thanking the plant. There's some plants, like Devil's Club, when you harvest that, I've learned there's a grandmother plant that's usually, you know, if it's on a hill, it's usually the one on the top of the hill, because the plant will fall down and that stalk will become the next roots, the roots for the next plant. And been told not to take the grandmother plant. You know, you take the smaller plants out at the outer edge. And then for the Devil's Club, some people use the root, which has a lot of medicine in it. But I suggest, if you want to use the roots for that plant, that, you know, just find someone who's doing some excavation and see if you can grab the Devil's Club roots if they have them on their property, rather than taking the whole plant. Because if you cut off the stalk of a Devil's Club above the lowest notch, it'll come back. I do, in the kits that I have, because some people will use a special plant to them, and that's where the tobacco, since it was scarce for a lot of people, that was a precious natural thing to leave a little bit of for the plant to show your gratitude. I also have, I've been working with Naomi Michelson. She has a nonprofit where she helps put together workshops and symposiums. We've been doing work with women's shelter programs in Southeast on doing plant workshops, but she had cedar. So I put some cedar in there, and then tobacco, cedar, and sage. So I've been growing some white sage here in my greenhouse, and I really like the combination of the three. And you process that too. I have just a dried plant material, and when you're crushing it up to put it in your little pouch, you think about, you know, the medicine that you'll find and who you'll share it with. And so it's from the beginning of just getting that ready, and then going out and making sure that you say thank you. So there is a process. Tobacco's been around in Alaska. I just got a new old book today that had information on tobacco being here since the late 1700s in some places. And Rita Blumenstein, the tribal doctor who has lived in Anchorage for a while now, she said that leaving some tobacco is good too. And if you don't have anything like that and you are at the right time to harvest something, you can leave a little piece of your hair, little beads.
How would you say thank you in King Island Inupiat?
Well, they would say Kwiana, but that's kind of Yupik. And my mom, before she passed away, said it was Taku, yeah. And I know here it's Chikinik for this area of the Dena'ina people. In Anchorage, it's Tinan. Yeah, and then, of course, southeast, it's hard for me to say it.
Gunashish?
Thank you. Yeah.
And that was Tia Holly, traditional wellness consultant for the Kanaitse Indian tribe and founder of Indigenous Herbals. If that interview seemed like it ended abruptly, it's because it did. I wish I could include our whole conversation, which led to diverse topics like intergenerational trauma, a history of tobacco in Alaska, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, Christianity through an Alaska Native lens, and a history of sewer that I was unaware of. I will be happy once this pandemic is over, and maybe, Tia, I can meet you for tea sometime. Coming up next, Nicola Revelo has your weekly roundup of events and opportunities in local ag.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits on local agriculture and wild habitat too. First, I'd like to let you know about a few webinars coming up. On Tuesday, March 30th, the Kachemak Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve is doing a presentation on the salmon landscapes we live in and the unseen underground water resources that sustain life and growth in the Kenai Lowlands, part of the Know Your Land series of talks. The research reserve is doing some cool things, and this talk brings them to you. The talk will feature their salmon and people landscape video and discussion on current uses or needs for water in our area, as well as data visualization of some of their research. There will be plenty of time for discussion with the audience and chances for us to share our thoughts with what we are curious about regarding salmon landscapes with the research reserve staff. The next webinar is for folks who have a local farm business or any other local business, and you'd like to learn how to produce super easy and free graphics to help you market it. This will take place March 31st. We will be showing a presentation on how to use Canva, a free online site, and all the cool things you can do without having any graphic design experience, things like logo making, brochures, and social media posts. After the presentation, Corinna Bench from My Digital Farmer will take any questions you have. Then, on April 7th and 8th, will be a pair of webinars on irrigating your crops with more precision. The first, on Wednesday, April 7th, is Optimize Irrigation for Your Farm or Garden with a Few Simple Tools, presented by civil engineer Alicia Green and soil conservationist Dave Ianson, both from USDA NRCS in Alaska. Water is the rope in a tug of war between plant roots and the soil. Help your plants win that war and thrive with soil moisture sensors and a flow meter in an effective irrigation water management plan. Then the next day, we will be bringing in a representative from Aerometer, a manufacturer who makes these soil moisture sensors, to talk about the concept behind soil moisture management and the associated products used to measure it. This talk will be geared for small-scale growers like many of you tuning in today. That's happening on Thursday, April 8th. You can find links to join any of the talks I've mentioned on the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District website in our events calendar or on our Facebook page. Coming up on April 9th is the Alaska Farmers Market Association 2021 Virtual Summit. This will be a full day of national and local speakers, skills workshops on grant writing and social media, updates from state agencies, and more. And it's not just for people involved with Alaskan farmers markets. It's open to everyone who likes and supports Alaskan-grown food. You can attend this virtual event at no charge. Registration and the full agenda can be found on the Alaska Farmers Market Association website. Just click the Trainings and Events tab, or you can find it on their Facebook page as well. For those of you out there who are into local food, there are several options to get in on right now. First, the Kenai Peninsula's online farmers market, the Alaska Food Hub, is already open for business. Last time I checked, they had smoked fish, shucked Jackalof Bay oysters, local potatoes, Kay Bay coffee, Two Sisters baked goods, seaweed-infused seasonings and kelp salsas, a variety of fermented local vegetables, and some non-food items as well, like wild-crafted herbal skin products and calendars from Homer's Own Alaska Beauty Peony Cooperative. Check it out at alaskafoodhub.org. And if you're someone who'd prefer to receive a box loaded with locally grown produce, herbs, and perhaps even fresh-cut flowers every week from May through October, then a CSA share might be your happy place. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. The farmers who offer this receive payment upfront at the beginning of the season from their customers, and then the customers receive boxes each week with a variety of types of produce, whatever's fresh and at its peak for harvest. There are three local farms offering CSA shares right now. Homer Hilltop Farm. Find them at homerhilltopfarm.com. Synergy Gardens. Find them at synergygardens.net. And Twitter Creek Gardens. Find them at twittercreekgardens.com. If new farms begin offering CSA shares, we'll let you know about it here on Homer Grown.
And that's the episode. I want to thank Elder Kathy Brewster and Tia Holly for talking with us about Alaska Native Plant Medicine. Thank you to the Bunnell Street Arts Center for chatting with me about land acknowledgments and ethics. Local musicians Carly Conomac, Kevin Cope, and Ryan Black for their musical contributions, and Nicole Arevalo for her work. Questions, comments, critiques? Email Desiree at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.